Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 305 for Friday, June 6th, 2014. Greetings from downtown Denver. This is recording a day earlier than usual in the week. That's because Darlene, the Yorkie Claire, and I have a reservation at a streamside cabin in the mountains west of Boulder, Colorado, this weekend. When we found it online, the place reminded Darlene of a cabin resort in the Black Hills where she has been going off and on ever since she was a girl. There is, as I understand it, going to be no internet and I think no cell phone coverage, so this is going to be a deep unplugging that we are both looking forward to. It strikes me that in the future, there may be an increasing market for vacation spots unreachable by the net in whatever form the net takes. If it's available, I find, and in talking to people, I find lots of others, it's just too easy to sneak a peek at an iPhone or a tablet, and the only real safe haven is just where it's not available. So I'm looking forward to some deep breaths and exhalations there by the stream. We will, of course, have our Kindle Paperwhites for reading on the deck by the stream and in the cabin by the gas fireplace at night. For this week's interview, I reconnected with Stephen Windwalker far from the mountains at his home in Arlington, Massachusetts. We spoke of many things, including the current impasse between Amazon and the publisher Hachette, a dispute that I dearly hope might have ended in a sudden and surprising agreement by the time that I returned to Denver and the Nets.
I think it's quite an interesting notion to think that they owe anything to Hachette in terms of using their own price and availability infrastructure to benefit Hachette if Hachette isn't going to agree to a contract with them.
In news, Amazon is preparing a very unusual rollout for its apparently very unusual new smartphone. It's scheduled for June 18th in Seattle. For the tech tip, I'm going to pass on a couple of more tips for fetching notes and highlights from your Kindle books in usable format. And in content, I'm going to recommend a novel that I didn't expect I would enjoy, but ended up falling in love with quite thoroughly. Well, there's really only one big news story this week that I want to talk about. Of course, the Hachette controversy still continues apace, and we'll hear a little bit about that in the interview. But yesterday, Amazon's homepage began showing a blue rectangle asking, "Want an invite to our new device unveiling?" It showed a black device with a bezeled corner and an Amazon logo, pretty clearly a smartphone or the corner of a smartphone. To the left of it is the date, Wednesday, June 18th, Seattle, and a link labeled "Request an invite to our launch event." When you click on that, you come to the request an invitation page titled "Join Amazon's founder Jeff Bezos for our launch event." A video appears next to the, again, a corner image of the phone, and you may want to watch this video yourself if you haven't already. As of Thursday afternoon, as I'm recording, it has been viewed 500,000 times. If even a small percentage of those viewers request invites, and if Amazon doesn't plan to disappoint the vast majority of people who request invites, I'm picturing a very large venue for this unveiling of the new phone. I did a quick search of venues in Seattle, and there's one called the Key Arena at Seattle Center. It holds, it has seats for 17,000 people, so that might be a start. Amazon is not being shy at generating interest in the new device, as you can hear by listening to the audio track of the video. As you listen to this picture, people with big smiles, and the speakers are sometimes moving their heads in odd motions, apparently triggering something amazing that perhaps is appearing to the eye as occurring just off the screen of the new Amazon phone.
That is awesome.
Huh. Oh, whoa.
It moved with me.
Whoa.
That's really cool.
It's amazing. It's very real life and uncomparable to anything I've seen.
I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah, this is neat. This is really neat.
I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy.
That's super awesome. I don't know how you guys do it.
It's pretty flawless and seamless.
Wow. That is really cool. How does it do that?
Whoa. That's pretty good. That, I'm impressed.
That's pretty damn intuitive.
That's really cool. I would use that a lot.
That's really cool.
That's fantastic.
Do I have to give this back?
We've talked quite a bit about what we think this phone is going to be like, and the five cameras that enable it to give a 3D effect and possibility of advancing pages when you're reading a book just by moving your head, or even perhaps noticing where your eye is focused on the page. There'll be plenty of coverage on that. I'll have some links in the show notes. I'd like to take a closer look at what's new as of yesterday, and that's this invitation. It's very intriguing to me. You know, Amazon loves to innovate on products and services. It also likes to innovate in how it gets its message across. And this is particularly interesting, I think, given the silence that the company has had, except for that one post that was on the one of the forums commenting on the Hachette situation. There's been absolutely no official response by anyone to any request on that matter. Now, by comparison, announcing this new product, they're apparently inviting the public to come to an event in Seattle. So if you request, if you click on the request an invitation, it's a very simple sign-up process. The first thing requests the email that is associated with your Amazon account, your first and last name, phone number, city, state, or province, and then it asks, are you an Amazon customer, a developer, or a journalist? And there are radio buttons there to click which one you want. Depending on which one you click, you'll go to sections that ask for slightly different information. If you're a customer, the questions are, why do you wish to attend this event? And there's a box and there's no character limit. So you could just wax poetic about why you want to come to the event, and someone apparently is going to be reading it and making some decisions. Below that, it says optional video submission. Please email a short video, approximately 30 seconds, to launchvideo@amazon.com explaining why you would like to attend. Please include your name in the email and send the video from the email address you entered above. So there's a chance to be creative in saying why you'd like to come as a customer. The next group are for developers, and there the questions are, what is your company's name? What is your professional email address? Which apps have you developed? Describe an innovative way in which you have used gyroscopes, accelerometers, or other device sensors in your app development. Now, I hadn't seen that before, so there's another clue as to what this device uses for its special effects. Next question is, are you interested in developing apps utilizing a new type of sensor? Do you have machine learning experience? Please describe. And then again, there's an optional video submission. Email a short video to launchvideo@amazon.com explaining why you would like to attend. And then the third, perhaps in descending order of importance to Amazon at this event, are media questions. And there are only three questions. What publication do you work for? What is your professional email address and website? So I'm sure media will have a chance to attend, as they have other Amazon events. The two that I've been at introduced the Kindle Fire and its newer version back in New York City and then in Santa Monica. Then there was an introduction of devices, the new Paperwhites, that simply took place on the web page. There wasn't any kind of event. And then another time, Amazon brought in key tech journalists for interviews with Jeff Bezos and demonstrations of the product. So this is sort of a fourth way of getting the word out on a major new product. And I think it's fascinating that, you know, to have a huge number of customers at this event, I think it's a bit of subtle media management, I think, because as we've seen in the Hachette controversy, you get sort of the professional, the journalists, some of the bloggers, there's sort of a very spirited debate going on among people who are professional observers. And the customers weigh in on comments frequently. I have, and I've seen others saying, you know, I get great service from Amazon. I love reading on the Kindle. And so that customer voice does get to come through in the comments to a lot of this coverage. But picture an event where the media is probably going to be outnumbered pretty significantly by customers. And and then also developers there as well. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's going to be kind of a token, you know, five front rows of customers, and depending on the size of the venue, largely more media there than customers. But I think a smart way to do it would be to make the point that this is a company that is driven by customer-centric focus, and its real power and the where its message has the most kind of valence is among customers. And what the New York Times writes about any particular item is perhaps not as much of as much interest as continuing this relationship with millions of customers. I have to say, it's amazing to me that I think it's been nearly 24 hours since this first came out. And of course, there's been a lot of coverage everywhere about this event. People have been expecting this phone, and now here it comes. There's a date set and all of that. The one place I haven't seen a single mention of this is the New York Times. And of course, they've been really riding this Hachette issue in a way that I think has been pretty biased, and others seem to agree. Let's do another search. I continue to search. I just type in Amazon at the Times website, and the only stories I see are Amazon's tactics confirm its critics' worst suspicions, the whole list of stories about the Hachette battle, and not a single item on this major new product that's being introduced. I don't understand how a paper that considers itself the paper of record and who has somebody covering Amazon can simply not mention a story like this. It's, you know, just when I think we've seen the most bias possible in covering a company, comes a new bit of data in which the newspaper simply ignores an event that would be very difficult to write about without, giving some push to what Amazon is wanting. I put up a tweet yesterday. I couldn't resist to say that I was looking forward to the Times' reporter starting the story about the launch in a clear attempt to distract from the Hachette negotiations, Amazon today, blah, 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 blah. But anyway, it's an amazing story. But don't be looking to the New York Times probably for a lot of coverage on this event. You will find good coverage really all over the net. There's Quartz, which is an interesting online publication, is talking about it and mentioning the simulated 3D display and interface. But says points to, I think, a pretty logical question, which is how deeply will Amazon price its phone and the mobile service that comes with it? With such strong competition from Apple and Samsung, there are few reasons for anyone to buy an Amazon phone other than price. That's barring an engineering design miracle. 3D alone likely won't cut it. And there's some possibilities, partnership with a major operator, a modest special offer of some sort. One thing I was disappointed to see is that T-Mobile might be involved, and given my experience with T-Mobile, when Darlene and I switched to T-Mobile because they had a great international plan, and then when we get to after we returned home and we couldn't get a signal in Omaha at her sister's house, I thought, nah, that's not going to work, and we went back to Verizon, and Verizon gladly deleted the penalty for getting out of the contract early, which T-Mobile had paid for us, and so we're now back on Verizon. It would really break my heart if I had to go back to T-Mobile in order to get the Amazon phone. For the tech tip, I've got something else I want to bring to your attention about exporting highlights and notes from your Kindle books. I talked about Snipify last week, and that's a pretty good tool for seeing your notes and annotations in a Kindle book, but you can only do it on the iPad or iPhone. And I one of the things that I've thought wasn't so great about using Kindle.amazon.com, which is the website that has all your annotations and highlights, is that you can't really search for a book. You have to scroll through page after page to find the annotations for a book. But I've discovered a useful hack on that, because I was, for the book that I'm going to talk to you about in content, The Fault in Our Stars, I had finished reading it last week, and I had some annotations on it, but since I've been reading a lot of other books since then, it wasn't going to be on the top of the list. So I went in and I just added an annotation to the book, just something in random that I highlighted. And I would say within a couple of minutes, it was available at kindle.amazon.com. It was when I went to when I clicked on your highlights, that book was at the top of the list. And then it was pretty easy to copy and paste it into a Word document. And then I did some trimming because there's some extraneous, edit and different things which make sense on the web page, which don't make sense in on a list of annotations that you're trying to work from. And so I boiled it down to about 2 pages of highlights that I was able to use in the review. So until Amazon I hope Amazon is going to improve this way to fetch your annotations. But meanwhile, if you have a specific book, simply add an annotation to it and then wait a minute or two, and that book will be available with all your annotations at kindle.amazon.com. I usually do my interviews with Stephen Windwalker, creator of Kindle Nation Daily and Book Gorilla, in person, either at his home in Arlington, Massachusetts, or mine in Cambridge. But for this most recent visit to the show, Steve arrived here in Denver on Tuesday, June 3rd, 2014, by way of an excellent Skype video connection, and his headset delivered pretty good quality for the podcast. One of the increasing satisfactions of doing this show is the ability to look back over nearly 6 years now to see what made sense in the early days of the Kindle, what different guests were predicting, and how much has changed. As I listened to some of my earlier conversations with Steve, I was struck by how often his earliest analyses of Amazon and the Kindle have been borne out by subsequent events. For example, he early on saw the importance of porting Kindle content beyond the Kindle itself to apps on other devices, and that turned out to be a crucial element in Amazon's success in jumpstarting the adoption of ebooks. In fact, Steve was paying close attention to and writing about Amazon well before the introduction of the Kindle, so his perspective in 2014 has some real historical depth to it. With that in mind, I began by asking him how he sees the current frenzied media coverage of negotiations underway between Amazon and the publisher Hachette.
Well, the first thing you have to do, it seems like every time there's a war, to use James Patterson's word, involving Amazon, is you have to clear away all of the bull about what's really going on here. Patterson said this is a national tragedy. John Green, an author who I like quite a bit and quite a few of our readers like, John Green said Amazon was trying to bully the publishing industry out of existence. And I don't see any of that. I guess what I see is that Amazon is looking for a little more flexibility. I think the irony here is that there's quite a track record of Amazon using whatever flexibility it is able to gain with publishers to sell more of what publishers are offering and to make publishers more profitable. Amazon obviously understands pricing in a way that probably nobody else does, and they by the more flexibility they have to offer discounts on ebook prices especially, and on certainly on print books as well, the more they're going to be able to sell, and the more money is going to end up in the pockets of the publishers. I mean, Amazon had to drag the traditional publishing industry kicking and screaming into the ebook, the Kindle revolution. And now, here we are, 6.5 years later, ebook publishing is the most profitable sector for all of those traditional publishers, and certainly all of the big six. And there's no reason to think that Amazon is going to try and do away with profits for the publishers it works with.
Do you think that I've seen some people suggest that what might be going on is that, since ebooks are the most profitable at this point, Amazon is making a bid to move some of those profits to its side of the table and get sort of a bigger piece of the pie, which probably would reduce profits for the publishers. But you're saying maybe that if they succeed in getting flexibility, even with that kind of a shift, there's going to be more profits to divvy up and the publishers might still be better off?
I think so. I think that the way Amazon approaches profitability, of course, is to multiply margin times number of units, which is a pretty elementary principle. But it, so often what we see from the publishers is that, and from many authors as well, is that they're so heavily focused on what is the margin percentage that they don't apply the other part of the equation, which is how many units are going to be sold. And Amazon understands very well that if they have the flexibility to discount one James Patterson title in order to sell more of the other 25 James Patterson titles that are going to be released in the next 6 months by the Patterson factory, then everybody's going to be better off in the long run. Nothing about Amazon's position suggests to me that they're going to, you know, that they're suddenly going to start trying to get 70% from publishers or anything like that.
Who do you think has the stronger position in this negotiation?
Well, I think they both have pretty strong positions. And, you know, and Hachette is no slouch. It's a $12 billion global corporation. So, you know, they're not your mom and pop operation. But I do think that what makes Amazon's position stronger is the fact that, one, readers don't particularly need Hachette. Amazon has so many publishers and so many independently published authors and so many small presses and so forth, that if Hachette were to go away, which is not going to happen as a presence in the Kindle store, for instance, or on the Amazon print books, readers have a lot of other great choices, and you know, I think all publishers have to understand that, and Hachette has to understand that. So that's a big part of Amazon's strength, and the other part of Amazon's strength is that Hachette is not really in a position to pull its books from Amazon, because Amazon accounts for over 40% of its overall market across all formats, and 67% of its ebook market share. If you're an author with a Hachette book, you're not going to stand for Hachette saying, we're going to stop selling on Amazon. It just isn't going to happen. And I'm sure what Amazon has done here with the print books is quite an object lesson for Hachette. I'm sure they've experienced a significant loss of sales, and it's just not something they're likely to want to do going forward. And the other big thing that's at stake, I'm sure, in the eyes of many of the participants or the many other publishers and authors and agents and so forth, many of the people who watch this industry, is the whole question of whether Amazon is acting in some way that is going to lead to some kind of a governmental or judicial intervention. I have to say that there's nothing about what Amazon has done that strikes me as the least bit problematic from a legal point of view, and I'm not a lawyer, but, you know, two of the most important elements of marketing, I think anyone would say, and certainly anyone who watches Amazon would say, are price and availability. And Amazon has built this colossus in the retail industry by having the best pricing and the best availability ever imagined. And so now what Amazon has done basically is to say that it's not going to use its powerful marketing tools of price and availability to benefit Hachette's print books. why wouldn't Amazon have the right to make that decision? They haven't said they're not going to carry. They've never said we're not going to carry Hachette's print books, but it's up to them whether they want to hold inventory or they just want to fulfill order by order, and it's up to them whether they want to fulfill whether they want to take pre-orders or just start shipping the book when it arrives. And I think it's quite an interesting notion to think that they owe anything to Hachette in terms of using their own price and availability infrastructure to benefit Hachette if Hachette isn't going to agree to a contract with them.
Do you think that the experience with Macmillan, what was that, 4 or 5 years ago, where Amazon did briefly pull the buy buttons on Macmillan, did that forever cure Amazon from using that particular weapon in this kind of a situation, or is that something that could still be part of this war?
Yeah, I suppose it could. I'd be surprised if it happened, but a natural consequence of that Macmillan kerfuffle and a similar controversy that took place between Barnes & Noble and Simon & Schuster about a year ago is that I'm sure Amazon, all parties, Amazon, the publishers, are constantly trying to figure out what leverage they have. And Amazon has probably figured out that it would be better to avoid pulling the buy buttons.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah, see. Sounds like they're using subtler tools this time than that
yeah.
one.
Yeah.
Well, meanwhile, the prices of ebook bestsellers, Bufo Calvin did an analysis that showed that it's been creeping up. And is that your sense, too, that aside from these negotiations, there has been an upward trend in ebook bestsellers?
I actually don't think there's been much of an upward trend overall. I think it's been pretty flat. There was something about the timing of Bufo's study that suggested to me that November and December every year is a natural time when there's going to be a lot of discounting. So if you come along in February or March and you compare the last 4 or 5 months, you're going to see a slight upward trend in bestseller pricing because one of the things that's going on in November and December is that by offering more discounting on bestsellers, Amazon is going to sell more Kindles, more hardware units. So I didn't see much in terms of the trend that Bufo was describing, although I think he had some good solid figures. I just saw some other macro trends that were also at work. But it's certainly true that all the time there are a lot of best-selling and new release books that are priced in the $9.99 up to $15 and sometimes even more range. And those are prices that a lot of Kindle owners like to avoid.
Well, that's a good time to shift to Book Gorilla because 14 months ago you created an ebook recommendation tool, which I think goes just to that, to help the patient purchaser get to better prices. So how does it work?
Exactly. There have been a lot of ebook recommendation tools, including several on Kindle Nation Daily, that have been focused primarily on the free books and the 99 centers and the independently published, helping to discover the kind of separate the wheat from the chaff as far as self-published authors go. But one of the things that we saw coming with the end of the agency model was that there was going to be more and more fierce price competition for best-selling books, for new releases, for mid-list books by very well-known writers, award-winning, you know, the Richard Fords and Sue Millers of the world. And what we try and do is we try and focus on the point when any book is going to be at its best price ever. And that just takes a lot of concentration and focus every morning, starting at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, using our software, using all the resources we have at our disposal. We want to promise, and we have promised our base of subscribers and app users and so forth, that we will help them, if they are willing to be patient, we will help them find the time when, instead of paying $9.99 or $12 or $15 for a new release from James Patterson or something that was on the bestseller list 3 months ago, they're going to be able to pay as little as $1, $2, $3 for that at some point, and we'll let them know when that point comes.
Can you say what kind of growth you've had in terms of the number of people who have subscribed to the email alerts and in the 14 months?
Sure. As we have email alerts, we have apps now on the Kindle Fire and other Android devices, and we have the Facebook communities, Twitter communities, and so forth. Altogether, we're in the ballpark now of a couple hundred thousand. So the growth has been fantastic, and it's currently upwards of 10% a month. So we're loving that, and to us, it's a real statement that what we're doing is hitting the sweet spot for people. We blend in free books and books by self-published authors and so forth, but every day we make sure that we are offering at least some books that are usually half a dozen to a dozen books by people that you really want to read, that our subscribers really want to read. And of course, we make it possible to select from over 100 different genres and subgenres so that you're getting the kind of books you want.
Now, and one of the things which I think differentiates you from others is that you're clear that you do have a number of books that are being promoted, but you limit that so that a high proportion of the books are books that you just think people are going to want to read.
That's right. If you're getting a list of books from us, chances are about 10 to 15% of those books are going to be ad-supported, whereas other sites that one could name, and I won't, have anywhere from 75 to 100% ad-supported books. And there's nothing wrong with that business model. It's worked very, very well for Kindle Nation Daily, but it's just different from the thing we need to do with Book Gorilla, and we have a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun curating the list, picking out real quality stuff, and sharing that with our subscribers.
Now, when I get my list, each book has a little description, and sometimes I think I can recognize your prose in those descriptions. How many of those do you end up writing at 5 in the morning?
Oh, dear. Well, there's one at 5 in the morning and another one at 5:07. It's funny. We use a lot of software in this process, and we use a lot of automation, but the actual writing of the first 20, 25 books that we list every day are, we actually write the copy, I don't want to go too far in that direction, because when there's something that's just wonderful, that really does the job on the book's Kindle page, that's the right length, we will certainly appropriate that. But we also feel like we want to speak to our readers about what we see with the book. Hmm.
Self-publishing, Hugh Howey's been tracking data with his anonymous data gnome, and I think making the point that the self-publishing part of the business is growing and accounting for an increasing amount of the activity at Amazon and also at Barnes & Noble. Do you have any sense of the breakdown of the books that you're recommending? Are there 20% self-published and the rest traditional, or do you have any idea what that breakdown is?
First, what Hugh Howey has been doing with that has been fantastic, and I think it's absolutely true that the number of books that are published in some way other than traditionally has just grown, and the success that they've been having has grown dramatically just every season. And what we're seeing is that more and more of the books, more and more of the books that we include in Book Gorilla are books that have been published by previously traditionally published authors, or they've been published, the actual books have been published in print before, and now the author has the rights back and has put up a shingle and is bringing the book to the Kindle store and to other platforms. All of these things I think are flourishing, and I think that the to go back to the Hachette kerfuffle, one of the things that's just true is that wherever a vacuum is created, if Hachette books are not going to occupy, you know, 10 or 15 or 12 of the top 100 spots in the Kindle store in terms of bestsellers, then there's plenty of other books that will come in, and that's definitely happened. And the other thing, you know, that it's certainly safe to say from our experience is that there hasn't been any decline in Amazon's Kindle book business. I mean, we have hundreds of thousands of books that are bought through Book Gorilla every month, and that's been on a steady upswing, both overall and per customer. So we don't see any evidence of a customer boycott or anything like that. Although I fully appreciate the importance of the New York Times trying to build the consensus for customer boycott, because with, you know, now that there are other, you know, the other big East Coast newspaper is owned by Jeff Bezos, it's natural that the New York Times would see its
I hadn't thought of this. This is a great new conspiracy theory that would explain the coverage of the New York. Oh man, that's good.
You know, it would explain it, Len, except for the fact that if you go to the Washington Post, and this, you know, I suppose Bezos deserves some credit for this, but if you go to the Washington Post coverage of the Hachette Amazon kerfuffle, it's been pretty tough on Amazon.
Exactly.
So my conspiracy theory goes nowhere. Forget about it.
And they don't get comments from Amazon either, so they're all in the same boat there.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things, I was listening to some of our previous conversations, which was a lot of fun, and 4 years ago, you told me that you imagined what you referred to as Bezos' nightmare, and that was your imagining a time when he realized that someone was going to create a digital book device that could result in a huge decline in Amazon's print sales, and then that led to the creation of the Kindle and this really bold creation of the Kindle Revolution, which they turned that potential nightmare obviously into a great opportunity. Can you imagine a Bezos nightmare that he might have now, looking ahead 10 years, specifically in the publishing industry, but perhaps more broadly than that, where they might be seeing something with the same kind of anticipation and have a similar level of kind of bold transformation of a threat into an opportunity?
You know, when I think about this, the current controversies, last year's controversies, every year's controversies with Amazon, there's all this whining that's always going on. And as we've discussed before, whining is not a business strategy. And I think that we can credit Jeff Bezos with that line, am I right?
Yep.
But with all the whining, there's constantly attention being paid, I mean, whether it's the New York Times or Chuck Schumer or whoever, who's saying, how can the Justice Department not be coming after Amazon? And I think it's really to Amazon's credit that it doesn't seem to be cowed by that kind of negativity. And so, you know, I take that one step further and I think, you know, it's really to Amazon's credit that they're not primarily lawyer-driven, although I'm sure there are people in the trademark and patent business who might say differently. But I think maybe a nightmare that I could imagine Bezos having is that the lawyers actually took over and started constraining the way that the Amazon does its business, so that it actually began to function less entrepreneurially. And so I think that, you know, obviously what what Bezos did with our other putative nightmare was he invented the Kindle. So what he's going to have to do with this nightmare, if he ever has it, is fire all the lawyers.
Now, that's an interesting insight, because you can certainly feel the drumbeat of that. And
I think they probably actually have lawyers who talk every day with the Justice Department. I mean, that's the kind of lawyers you want, who not only have some insight, but also are constantly making the connections and making sure that there's an understood rationale for what Amazon feels it has to do.
I have been speaking with Stephen Windwalker, creator of Kindle Nation Daily and Book Gorilla. Thanks very much, Steve.
Len, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
In content, I want to rave about a book whose author, John Green, has not impressed me with his grasp of the Hachette-Amazon dispute. Green, along with James Patterson, has taken to the internets to protest Amazon's negotiating tactics. So that's that, but I don't hold this against Green's best-selling young adult novel, The Fault in Our Stars, which I finished last week. The book was recommended to me by listener Sam Hendricks, and I will confess that I was not immediately drawn to it in first checking out the Kindle store listing. I enjoyed The Hunger Games, but generally don't read much YA fiction. In addition, Green's YA novel is about teens with terminal cancer. That sounded like kind of a grim read to me. I plunged in anyway, curious about the book's popularity. Today, The Fault in Our Stars is the number one bestseller in the Kindle store, and it has a mind-boggling 15,196 five-star reviews on Amazon. The trailer for the movie that opens tomorrow, June 6th, has been viewed more than 20 million times on YouTube. The story in the book is narrated by Hazel Grace Lancaster, who is 16 years old and clinically depressed after surviving 3 years with stage 4 cancer. At a support group, she meets Augustus Waters, who has lost a leg to cancer. He wears a prosthesis. I overcame my qualms about the book very soon into the reading of it. Hazel and Gus, two bright and highly original characters, fall in love as they deal with their medical trials and crises. They and their friends speak about the unspeakable with wit and wisdom beyond their years. Hazel early on tells the reader, quote, "There is only one thing in this world shittier than biting it from cancer when you're 16, and that's having a kid who bites it from cancer." She explains Gus's form of cancer, osteosarcoma, by saying, quote, "It sometimes takes a limb to check you out. Then, if it likes you, it takes the rest." When her mother asks Hazel if it's still cool to go to the mall these days, her daughter replies, "I take quite a bit of pride in not knowing what's cool." So that's cool. Gus has a cool habit of holding an unlit cigarette between his fingers without ever smoking. He flicks it as if to get rid of the ash. So I found it easy to like these two young lovers because of the fine characterizations that Green achieves. How they fall in love in this intense medical setting is remarkable, believable, and I found unforgettable. As Hazel describes it, "I fell in love the way you fall asleep, slowly, then all at once." The all-at-once moment of falling completely into this novel happened very early into the reading of it for me. If you know someone battling cancer of any age, I think this book will move you and provide a healing understanding of what they might be going through. One flawed elderly author figures prominently in the story because Hazel loves his book and wants him to tell her what happens after the book ends. He does tell her at one point, "Grief does not change you, Hazel. It reveals you." We all live with uncertainty, of course, but certain challenges in life, like cancer, make it more visible, more difficult to hide from. I think a great novel can give us the chance to try on levels of uncertainty that we haven't experienced yet in our own lives, to see how it feels and how paying attention sometimes seems to be the best way through. That's it for this week. My guest next week will be Amazon's Vice President for Kindle Content, Russ Grandinetti. I suspect he has been intimately involved in the Hachette negotiations, since he is the one who personally escorted Macmillan CEO John Sargent from the Amazon building in 2010, when Sargent's demand that e-books be windowed for delayed publication after print books led to an abrupt end of those talks and the brief removal of Macmillan's buy buttons. Much as I'd love to have Grandinetti make some news on the Kindle Chronicles, I know that's not going to happen, so in all likelihood there will be nothing said about Hachette, but that leaves plenty to talk about, so I hope that you'll tune in for this opportunity to hear again from one of the key players in Amazon's continued waging of the Kindle Revolution. This is Len Edgerly in downtown Denver, Colorado for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.